Hello.
Can we do the whole show in like a soft whisper?
I would rather not.
How's your voice? Is your second podcast of the day? You still got voice left in you?
I'm still good. I am operating as
you are currently functional. Yeah. JoeBot is currently functional, though not optimal.
I mean, who's really optimal these days?
People in their 20s, probably.
Jerks. Don't know how good they have it. No,
ain't the truth.
Yeah, no, it's been a long week and a long month, and a lot of stuff going on. A lot of pans in the fire, and everything's on fire.
A lot of irons on the stove and pans on the fire.
Yes, yes, yes. I you know, love me a good cast iron enamel Dutch oven Le Creuset thing to cook in. So yes, the iron's on the stove. Why not?
I was watching some beat Bobby Flay and they made paella in a paella.
You shouldn't do that in a time constrained environment like that.
Mm. See, the one guy went family style and Bobby Flay made a tiny I just saw the gif you post.
Personal paellas?
He made personal paellas, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, sorry, the obnoxious male posturing gif is the best thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, well, I just typed in out of sight, and it came up, and I was like, why not? we're talking.
Oh, poor Andy. He got his heart broken.
I don't feel bad for those guys.
He just flew in from the Apple, you know, mm-hmm. New York to pitch Hiram Walker Distillery.
I genuinely like that scene of her shutting him down. but yes, it's so silly. This movie I had not seen before. Out of Sight, had not watched it. And you said
you're very glad you did, and you love absolutely every single second of it. End of podcast. Goodbye, everyone.
Yeah, short show. No, I actually a controversial opinion. I don't love this. It's okay. I like to get shorty better.
Oh, how dare you! this podcast is over.
Well, there's just something ridiculous about the scenario that requires a certain amount of levity, and there's some levity in this movie, but for the most part, it's pretty serious about itself, in a strange late '90s way that doesn't necessarily super click for me. Also, I'm okay with George Clooney's performance in this as some charismatic bank robber, but I gotta say, J Lo, no.
this was early in her career. I'm not necessarily advocating that you grade her on a curve, but I think she sells the part at least well enough to be invested in the relationship between the two of them.
I mean, it's not as bad as Denise Richards' Nuclear Scientist, but
no, it's not even on the same plane as that. So like, no. Selena was 97; it was the year before this. Like, she really hadn't been in features for more than like 2-3 years here.
No, but then I was reading on the Wikipedia page that Sandra Bullock had been approached for this part, but one of the producers or something was like, yeah, they had great chemistry, but it wasn't the kind of chemistry we needed for an Elmore Leonard novel. And I was like, what?
Yeah, that was Soderbergh who said that.
She would have been so perfect for this.
Nah.
I don't understand.
Nah, JLo's better. Because then you got Dennis Farina in there, and they look like family. It's perfect.
Okay, well,
Dennis Farina does not look like he's related to Sandra Bullock, unfortunately.
Well, okay, whatever. But Sandra Bullock, if you're casting around your main actors and not necessarily casting around the cameo of Dennis Farina in the movie, then I would suggest Sandra Bullock in that case, because she's just a far more appealing actress at this point in her career than J-Lo was at this time. And she would go on to play an FBI agent in two other movies. Do you know what those movies are, Dan?
Miss Congeniality 1 and 2?
Yes, good guess.
That is certainly not the tone that this movie warrants.
But I don't know. It's just, J-Lo doesn't sell it for me. There's so many times where she's just kind of like, mumbling a line and kind of staring off screen, and then she kind of squints a little, but then like doesn't, and then she'll straighten her face back out, and it's just like this.
Some of her delivery is a little suboptimal, but I still think she's great in the role.
She is very wooden. And I usually champion women in these roles because they get to do things that are not typically granted for these sorts of gender scenarios. Like, she's an FBI agent who, you know, is responsible for taking people down, and she's tough and smart, etc. But then counter to that, she's got goo-goo eyes for dirty George Clooney in the back of a trunk, and it really sours a lot of this experience for me, because all that whip smart amazingness goes out the window because of that. And I know
love is a rational Joseph. They get to that part later.
No, well, love is a battlefield is what love is. But Pat Benatar taught us
shimmy.
But this it doesn't super really work for me. Also, I have to say that there is something incredibly 90s about the construction of a lot of this, where we have freeze frames that turn into dissolves, really long dissolves, not like quick dissolves, like really long dissolves, where you're just like, what is happening? And then we get dissolves that are in dissolves and dissolves, like we got a multi-dissolve thing going on.
Thankfully, they're used relatively sparingly.
But it, every time it would happen, especially the freeze frames, I was just like, is this an art project? Like,
yeah, it's a movie. It's artsy.
No, art project, not art. That's there's a distinct difference.
Oh, poo.
Because it really, really had that feeling of I'm just learning what I'm doing. And sure enough, as you had mentioned to me when I had pointed this out, when I had asked if this was something he was doing when he was still in school, you said that this was his first big thing that wasn't just like a little indie thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
We're all well aware of Steven Soderbergh's peculiar artsy preferences when it comes to filmmaking. He's a very odd man in the way he does things technically, but for some reason it mostly works for him in the instances he chooses to be unusual and odd. So I think this is another instance where it works perfectly. The instances where they do the freeze frames and the time shifting and the weird scene cutting and stuff, I think it all suits this story and adds something to it. If this was a straight procedural, linear, kind of just regularly cut movie, it would not be nearly as interesting to me personally as this movie is in its current state.
Well, if it was a linear movie, then you wouldn't have your introduction to Jennifer Lopez for a very long time. So they obviously can't construct it in that way. Otherwise, it makes the romantic nature of their relationship all the more ludicrous, because they'd basically be falling in love in the last half hour of the movie. But the way this all works out is we have a guy who is ripping off a tie and goes to a SunTrust bank. That's how you know you're in Florida. Goes to a SunTrust bank.
is that a known thing in Florida, the SunTrust?
Yes, it is a big Florida bank. And there's also those street lights where everything's horizontal above the intersection, like that. There are a lot of those in Tampa,
too. Oh, like on strings or what, or wires?
No, they're not on wires. The ones where there's like a curved pole and then everything's just like in a straight row. All the lights are in a row as opposed to hanging down. But anywho, that's neither here nor there. It looks very Florida when you see it. And he makes his way over to the bank, does the whole bank robbing thing. And I believe that we in the audience, at least I knew that none of what he was saying was true. And then he got the money and got to his car, and his car didn't start. And then he was arrested. And then we see him in Glades, the Belglades correctional facility. And this is the first instance of freeze frame and then dissolve to a moving camera in a car or a truck or whatever. That's showing all the grass and whatever outside the correctional facility. And terrible font for the movie, by the way. I loathe it. And then they get inside, and we see that there's a relationship, a dynamic at play, between him and some other people. And there's Luis Guzman, who is always interesting to see. He's in a relationship with another prison member, and that comes into play later on for something involving Guzman and what's her face? There's the ex-wife, confidant, whatever, that mm-hmm. Clooney calls. I don't remember her name.
Adele DeLisi.
Yeah, she doesn't feature in the movie as much as I thought she would have, based on her prominence in like helping plan the escape and being part of the Voice on the Outside. She's got two scenes.
I love how little she cares about everything that is going on in his life.
Yes, yes. And like all the stuff that really matters to her is her career and stuff.
She's a magician's assistant, Catherine Keener, mm-hmm. of other properties that you've probably seen.
Not really recognizable with that Katie Segal like red
the hair and the spandex and the things. It's all very bright.
Yeah. But she's got a thing, and so he makes his plan and he talks to the guard, and then his plan is to piggyback off of this other plan by ruining the other escape. And so this all goes through, except we have our introduction to Jennifer Lopez. She's having lunch with Dennis Farina, and he presents her with a gun, which is an interesting present. And they...
From, the father cop to daughter cop.
Yeah, and Dennis Farina had, of course, been in a different Elmore Leonard movie, Get Shorty, where he was the bad guy in South Florida, and now he's a good guy in South Florida. So you take it and you turn it.
He's retired now, so his job consists entirely of giving Michael Keaton shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is a scene, singular, that comes into play later. But they briefly do mention that she's dating Ray Nicolette, and Dennis Farina gives a lot of crap about that. And then she says that she's got to go whatever. I forget the whole thing, but she goes to the facility and she sees them trying to escape. She busts them. And then George Clooney.
She's a little stunned how quickly the tower guards go from like there's some people digging their way out to fire the automatic weapons and kill them.
Yeah, that was shocking for me as well. I was like, wow, we didn't really like do anything else in that process, did we? But
prison break in Florida is high stakes, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, it's hot, it's humid, it's dark. You don't want to go running after them.
Not, especially if you're not properly hydrated. You'll get, you know.
Yeah, you just gun them down. That's the only recourse that makes any sense. But anyway, she's got her car there, and so she's got her shotgun that she takes out, in addition to her birthday pistol. She catches George Clooney, who comes up afterwards. Now, Ving Rhames has seen this whole entire thing because he's the buddy who's supposed to be picking them up. And so he moves in from the other side. And so they get her, stuff her in the trunk, and George Clooney goes in the trunk with her. And Ving Rhames drives her police car. I don't know. It's not a police car. It's her government FBI car to their escape route. And George Clooney gets to talk to Jennifer Lopez about, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and how he mm-hmm. liked that movie, and it had you know, what's her name, Faye Dunaway, and they get to have their best mimicry of a Tarantino scene, I guess, in this movie.
This feels like a Tarantino scene to you?
Well, just that they're talking about like movies that they've seen, because they pivot from this to discussing another film. So it's just one of those things where Tarantino, because he, I guess, worked at a video store and has an affinity for these things, always works in a
like
lot
you
of...
say an affinity for these things. I think the technical term is he has a hard-on for these things.
Well, I try not to think about that capacity for him, but good, good.
We're all humans, Joe.
Mm-hmm. Yep, everybody... does something. And so
you didn't find the trunk scene charming at all?
No, the opposite of charming. And I wondered where the light source was that was illuminating them so evenly.
It's the brake lights and stuff and the running lights.
there was additional supplemental sources
there
of
was
light.
Additional light. This is also the first scene where whether you like what's happening or not, the music is introduced, music by David Holmes that I absolutely love in this movie. I can't really call this a score, right? It's not really a score, it's just kind of like jazzy bluesy type stuff in the movie.
It's a score, Dan.
Fine, it's a score. Anyway,
it's interesting because he forms a lasting partnership with him to do many other films, like the Ocean's movies, which have a lot more of that jazzy thing going on. And yeah, you get your George Clooney and actors.
And your Soderbergh there. I love the music in this movie. I especially love the places and the ways that it slows down and speeds up to allow for, you know, like when the cop car goes by, how it kind of just drops out the drum beat for a little while so you can hear the car go past. And all of the tracks on the actual album, if you download it, are the same way. And that's probably why I know the movie so well, because a lot of the quotes and stuff are like tracks on there as well. And the songs are just great. I love them to death so much. I can't even explain why.
Okay, well, that's nice. Good for you. Somehow she is attracted to him over this, but they stop to switch cars, and he gets out, and she reaches for her birthday pistol, and she...
I was like, birthday pistol, it makes me laugh.
Well,
it's like birthday suit, but it's the gun you were born with.
she shoots at him, but mostly her trunk. And then there's a discussion with Ving Rhames where he correctly points out that they could just leave the car there and that she'll be found. And this works out great for them because they need to ditch the car anyways and meet Glenn. George Clooney doesn't want to do that because he feels like there was some chemistry there. And if they had met under different circumstances, they could be together.
He just wants to talk to her. He just wants to, as Ving Rhames mockingly points out, you want to take a shower, come out of the bathroom in your aftershave, and sit down, and she's going to say, oh, I had you all wrong?
Yeah.
He just wants to talk to her, because, you know, as they get to later in that scene that you didn't like, which you're wrong about, you know, they have one of those fleeting moments where they see each other, and they have a brief moment, and they realize that there's something there, and they want to try and capture that for as long as possible, although, you know, star-crossed lovers, etc., an FBI agent and a bank robber. When you say it like that, it sounds really stupid, but I really do like the characters here. I like Jack Foley as this sort of like repeat offender, like nonviolent bank robber who just really has no idea how to apply his skills as a charismatic human being.
Mm. Yeah, that again goes back to an issue that I have. Now, I'm sure that might have been an issue that I had with the novel because I just find this scenario implausible that they fell in love, but...
you're allowed to say you don't believe in love. It's fine.
I especially don't believe in this particular scenario for falling in love. But
it's a movie.
They meet up with Glenn, who is Steve Zahn, who is great, because he's always hilarious, and he gets to play a character that he can do well. So he does it well.
He's a pretty good Glenn.
Yeah,
my favorite scene is when he actually meets up, his last scene when he meets up with J-Lo in the car, when he's yelling about how he can't be stealing the car again because he stole it a week ago in Florida, so he can't be stealing it again now, can I?
Yeah. I was disappointed that there wasn't more of him in the film. I thought he would have gone along with them to the final thing.
Yeah, he's gutless, though, as evidenced by as soon as he gets to Detroit. He just, you know, he realizes he can't hang and he has to get out of there.
Yeah, well, except he does... peer pressure murder somebody,
I'm not sure he actually does anything other than stand there and get sprayed with blood and lose his glasses, but yes, he's there. He is an accessory to murder.
Yes, but anywho, we're getting ahead of ourselves. They are there with the car and stuff, and he decides he's going to take J-Lo with them, and so there's the handcuffing, and then she comes along, and they stuff her in the back seat, and then they go argue about this with Glenn and her in the car. She gets her she puts her hands through her legs, et cetera, to get the handcuffed hands out from behind her back. And
she psychologizes him because he's stoned and stupid.
Yes.
And basically
yes.
says, you're about to aid and abet prison escapees. You should probably not do that and drive away. And he does.
Yeah, it's just like Saving Silverman. But
it's literally exactly like Saving Silverman, except nobody gets a tranquilizer dart.
Or a Big Montana. But
oh, right. The Big Montana. That was weird.
I want to do that movie sometime. I really like it. But, boy. It's so dumb and so bad. And I don't think you can stream it for free, but I have a DVD of it, which is amazing. But anyway, maybe Amanda Peet could have been a good FBI agent.
Has a very serious face.
She's a very serious face. But they have this...
Have you seen The Whole Nine Yards, by the way?
That's that Adam Sandler one?
No, it's Matthew Perry and Bruce Willis.
Oh. What am I thinking of? I thought it had nine in it.
Eight Crazy Nights?
No.
The animated Hanukkah movie?
No, there's the one where they're like playing football or whatever.
The Longest Yard?
Maybe. I don't know. Anyway, there's a yard. But
yeah, they're in prison and they play football. And
yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. All right.
Chris Rock is there.
Unfortunately, that's what I'm
thinking. No, this is the one where Bruce Willis is a hitman who lives next door to Matthew Perry. And Matthew Perry is very Matthew Perry.
Could he be any more Matthew Perry? But
in the whole 10 yards, he's a little bit more Matthew Perry than he is in the whole 9 yards.
Wait, is that actually a sequel?
It is actually a sequel.
You're not
yes.
just making that up.
I wish I was making it up, but no. I'm not.
And not an Elmore Leonard novel, you say?
It is certainly no.
Okay.
No.
Well, so anywho, he's great and he's easily convinced that this is something where he's going to get in trouble and that he should go, and they drive off much to the chagrin of George Clooney and Ving Rhames, who are just staring at that car going away, and they get back to his place and stuff, and then we have a dream sequence.
I was gonna say, how did you enjoy the dream sequence? You probably hated it, didn't you? You're like, what are you doing, J-Lo?
Well, I didn't like it because I immediately clocked it as a dream sequence.
Did you? Was it the music cranking up really loud, or the suspicious candle sitting next to his head by the bathtub?
Also, the fact that they just cut from that to her immediately finding them with no in between. So she's obviously fantasizing about finding him and how that scenario would go.
Did you know whose fantasy it was?
It was her fantasy.
Yeah, I know, but like beforehand, you said you clocked it as a dream sequence. Did you know whose?
Yes. Because he's the one who's in the tub.
Okay.
Naked.
Sure.
And she's the one with the power and the authority in the scenario and is going to go in there.
Well, maybe he's into that. You don't know.
Yeah. Well, I guess. But not to judge George Clooney's imaginary dreams in an Elmore Leonard novel-based movie directed by Steven Soderbergh, but I really think it was a Jennifer Lopez thing, and it was correct, because we have her waking up in the hospital, and Dennis Farina's there, and they talk about what it had happened, and she's got a bump on her head, and then FBI agent guy comes in, and they talk about, do you remember the scenario or whatever that got you into this situation? And she's like, yeah, I hit my head, you know, when we were getting away, and I was trying to jerk the steering wheel over to the exit. They cut to that scenario where she's trying to tell Steve Zahn, and Steve Zahn's panicking, and he's like, I only listened to you because I was high, and I smoked all that pot.
Wrong.
Yeah, I shouldn't have done that, and I'm in so much trouble. And then she jerks the wheel, and they crash, and then Steve Zahn walks away from the crash and
just
leaves her there.
Just trots away from this accident. This is one of the again, I forgive all of this because I love this movie to death, but one of the few things in this movie that actually does bother me is the fact that when they hit the barrel, she hits the left side of her head and the bruises on the right side of her head in the hospital, but whatever, it's fine.
Oh, wow.
I'm not paying too much attention to this movie, am I?
I mean, I will let you in on a little secret. I did not notice or care. But that's
when
not...
you watch it another 20 more times and realize that everything about the movie is great, you'll start noticing these details.
I sure will. And so she is like, she wants to be back on the case and stuff, and the guy's like, that doesn't seem like a good idea. And she is gonna go back to hang out with Dennis Farina, and we meet Michael Keaton, And in between all of this, there's a non-linear whatever of a boxing match in a prison fight in Lompoc, California.
We get to meet Snoopy Mad Dog Miller.
Yes, played by Don Cheadle, who is great in this role. I like Don Cheadle. He gets an interesting little setup here. We get Albert Brooks. Who I initially did not recognize as Albert Brooks.
there are a handful of people in this movie that it took me a very long time to recognize. Isaiah Washington, I mean, he stands out, but he's, you know, fairly well covered. You got, what's her name, playing Moselle? Oh, God, what's her name? Viola Davis.
What?
Yeah, it was Moselle. That one took me a very, very long time to recognize.
I didn't know. Well, she's got a lot of makeup, and she put her heart and soul into that role. But
yeah, she's got some big crazy hair and she's making some faces too the whole time. She's, you know, got that robe on.
Yeah. But Don Cheadle's good. But they have this whole thing where somebody gets shanked and it's witnessed and then pushed along, and then there's a transaction that's occurring in the library where Snoop is demanding money for all of the things that he's going to bring in for Ripley, who is played by Albert Brooks. And,
oh, I just realized, you know, Jaime, the guy that Clooney hits with the book when they're in the library and they get in trouble, he's from a lot of stuff. You remember one thing in particular that he's from?
Do
your
I?
Your favorite movie of all time.
What is my favorite movie of all time?
Detention. He plays the football coach.
Oh.
Ready for the big game tonight, coach?
Always ready for football!
I can't believe I didn't remember that.
I didn't remember that either. It's okay. Yeah, he's good as Jaime. He's big and intimidating.
I suppose. He's not heavily featured in the film, Dan.
No, I know.
but they...
All of these characters are very familiar to me.
They're just like family.
Yeah, exactly.
Was watching this movie just like visiting your extended family?
No, it's like going to the Olive Garden when you're there, when you're watching this movie, your family.
You're... Soderbergh salad and breadsticks.
Oh man, like it's unlimited, but it's really weird. Like it's bathed in red light, and like they just don't give you anything to dip it in. You just get the bread by itself. It's really good though, but it's just like, is there a sauce? Am I supposed to like wait till the red light turns off? Is the red light heating it up? I'm not sure what's going on here. And then you know the breadstick is like 12 feet long, and you're like, are we allowed to cut it? Is it one contiguous breadstick? I don't understand what's going on here.
This worked out too well.
Oh, that's great. Yes. Yeah. When you're here, your family, though. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, but George Clooney tells Ripley not to pay for these things, and he's like, well, I think I got it. Otherwise, I'm going to be in trouble. I'm going to be shanked or shivved or whatever. And... George Clooney says, no, he's not going to do that because then you'll be transferred and then he won't have anybody to extort. So you've negotiating leverage or whatever.
Politics of prison extortion.
Yeah. And so Jaime comes over and George Clooney beats him up and then the whole thing's called off. And then the goldfish that Don Cheadle was giving to Albert Brooks, they get killed as a consequence of this.
That's how you do the shake. You make a fist.
But
you don't find any of this particularly clever and amusing?
I mean, I find it like somewhat amusing. I wasn't like rolling on the floor with laughter over it, but
well, it's not that kind of movie.
No, but
again,
I mean,
it's not Mafia.
Yeah, but I did. I just circled and highlighted and pointed out that I found the goldfish thing interesting. Uh-huh. But
don't
whatever.
Give me your faint praise.
Yes. Sorry, I don't love your family enough, but they have that whole thing, but that's important because it sets up what's actually the plot that's driving everything in this movie. Although it doesn't really seem like it at the time, because at the time you're just like, these are weird flashbacks we're having.
Yeah, you meet Loudmouth Glenn, who's apparently laundry mates with Ripley, who we discover is a I don't know, some sort of financial bad person.
Yeah, they call him a Wall Street guy, and they say that he made George Clooney criticizes him and says that he made his money by marrying a wife and then who was rich and then selling off everything that she had piece by piece.
And then divorcing her. Yes.
Yeah. So that he's Ripley's not a good guy, obviously, and he's
presumably in jail for some sort of money laundering or bad business deals.
Yeah, I'm sure it's some Martha Stewart thing. But he's although it does seem like a significantly tougher jail than I would have expected for his white collar crime.
Yeah, if he was in a white collar prison, they'd probably let him keep his toupee,
I guess. Also, it's not entirely clear why he went to prison in Lompoc, since he seems to go back and forth between Palm Beach and Detroit. So I don't know why that is.
Maybe his Florida office is where they did all of the laundering.
But why would
they owned a series of local nightclubs or something?
Well, why would that send him to Lompoc?
I don't know.
You know where Lompoc is?
Oh no, I have no idea. Wait, no, was he in? Was he in Lompoc or was he in Glades?
These flashbacks were to Lompoc because Lompoc is where Glenn was and Buddy was.
Oh, right.
Yes. Huh. And Glades is only briefly at the beginning of this movie. All these other prison flashbacks are to Lompoc. But Lompoc is interesting because...
Is it because it's specifically a federal place for FBI-type peoples?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I went to wine tastings in Lompoc. I didn't really tour the prison facility.
Well, you should have stopped by and, you know, made sure that everything was above board.
Excuse me, sir. I have some questions about the plot of Out of Sight.
I'm going to need you to clarify a few things.
Yeah.
Do you, in fact, have a quiet please sign in your library? Mm-hmm. And, like, little cages in the corners where, I don't know, particularly unruly inmates have to sit when they're reading their books?
I'm not going to pretend I know how the dynamics of that work, but the important thing is we set up this whole plot that, again, we don't know about, where Ripley has uncut diamonds, and George Clooney and Glenn were trying to insinuate themselves into Ripley's good graces so that they could get towards this, and Ripley makes some false promises to George Clooney about how George Clooney should come work for him because he's a real smart guy and understands lots of stuff. And this is obviously...
Somebody knows how to ask for what they want and in a way that, you know, convinces people without using force.
Yeah, but yeah. He's just blowing smoke up his butt. Much later in the film, we flash back to the beginning of this film, basically, right before the beginning of this film, where... He actually had gone to Ripley for that job, and it was a security guard job, and so he confronted Ripley about it, and Ripley says, you're not really good at anything, etc., and gets him kicked out, and that's when he rips off his tie. And that's what sets everything in motion for this. But...
I like that his gray suit has an orange interior.
It was a snappy suit.
Am I watching the movie too close?
Yeah.
Anyway, but, one of the things that I really like is
it occurs, 42 regular.
42 regular, exactly. This one of the scenes that occurs around here, and again, this being an Elmore Leonard story, you're not really certain what the exact flow of operations is when recalling it, but it generally goes together pretty well in a straight line when you're watching it. And I think this movie probably flows better than some of the other ones that we've watched, maybe a little bit better than Jackie Brown in terms of understanding the flow. But the scene that I love is when they're back at Buddy's place and he's like fishing through Karen's wallet, and Ving Rhames throws the beer to him and he completely obliviously misses it, and he's like, he mumbles under his breath like, it's fine, it landed in the pool, don't worry about it. And he's not even paying attention at all to this whole like, we have to get out of town fast. He's just going through her wallet, looking at photos, and then Ving Rhames snatches her like driver's license out of his hand and like holds it over the ledge to like get his attention. He's like, hey, just don't do that. What are you doing? Give me back the driver's license. I gotta put it back in the purse here. Don't be disrespectful.
Yeah, and Ving Rhames wants to get this whole show on the road with going to Detroit, and that is a big part of this. But first, we need to meet Ray Nicolette in his scene where he goes over to Dennis Farina's house, where Jennifer Lopez is staying, and he's introduced to Dennis Farina, and Dennis Farina is confrontational, as expected.
Hypothetically confrontational, you know, he's, I guess, from what I can suss out after having watched this many times, this story that he's recounting from the newspaper is actually about Chirino, one of the escapees, Luis Guzman, who was, like, hiding out in some woman's house, or no, it wouldn't be him. Anyway, I thought they were talking about Chirino. Maybe they're talking about a couple things at once. Anyway, the point of the story is that Ray Nicolette is a moron. He's wearing a giant shirt that says FBI. He's wearing your favorite leather jacket in all of his scenes because it's, you know, just loud and noisy. Mm-hmm. And he's
Do you have another shirt that says undercover?
Yeah, exactly. I love that I can't read Michael Keaton's face well enough to know if he's actually thinking it through or if he actually understands that he's just immediately being made fun of. He just kind of rolls with it and then says no. But based on the long pause, I feel like he takes it seriously for a moment. He's getting divorced, but he's not divorced. But they're separated, but he hasn't moved out, but he's dating Jennifer Lopez. So Dennis Farina, being the slightly protective former police officer father that he is, can't help but just, you know, poke and prod at his character a little bit and not so subtly tell him that he's kind of a bad person.
Yeah, and that he even warns Jennifer Lopez, like, you know, this is the kind of guy who will cheat on you and blah, 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 blah. So he's not approving of Ray Nicolette. But this is the only Ray Nicolette scene in the movie, and then he leaves.
He's on TV. At one point, when they're watching the highlights at Ving Rhames' apartment, you see him, you know, talk to a reporter in his FBI little SWAT vest and then, like, walk away.
Yeah, but, I mean, he had one day of shooting. The end.
Yeah. This is a quick little cameo.
Yeah. I do like the behind-the-scenes part of this where Danny DeVito, after having been in Get Shorty, acquired the rights to this movie, to this Elmore Leonard novel that became this movie, and somehow in the process, when Steven Soderbergh was hired as director, he wanted to hire who Tarantino had hired to play Nicolette in the previous year. So we get that cameo, and we also get cameos from all of the other stuff. So there are Dennis Farina, for example, who was in Get Shorty, appears, and Sam Jackson has a brief cameo at the end. He's not playing the same character. The only one who's playing the same character is Ray Nicolette.
Or is he playing the same character? And Ordell's real name is actually, well, maybe he changed his name. No, he got shot.
He's dead.
He's dead.
He's super
or
dead.
Or did he fake it?
Yes, he faked his death.
He faked all of that blood pouring out of him onto the floor of that bail bonds place.
Yeah, he faked his death and then became a criminal expert at escaping prisons by the end of the film.
I mean, he had a nickname, so we can't prove that he's not Ordell, aside from the fact that Ordell died.
Yes. But anywho, it's just an interesting touch in terms of production. So I do think it's fun that Ray Nicolette is played by Michael Keaton and appears here. But in terms of, like, the movie, it doesn't seem to add anything or really detract anything. It's just a fun little nod.
Yeah. And it's a little different than the Ray Nicolette we saw in the other movie. He's a little dumber.
Well, I mean, that's necessary, I suppose, for Dennis Farina to be having the leg up in the conversations that they're having. But and also it's interesting because Danny DeVito is a producer on this and Barry Sonnenfeld are producers on this. Apparently Quentin Tarantino didn't want Miramax to charge Universal Studios for the use of the character. He's like, you know, it's gotta just go through, like, it's gotta be cool. Be cool, man.
Which is the sequel to Get Shorty.
Oh God, it is.
Be cool.
Oh,
yeah.
We talked about this. Oh.
We're doing that next week. No, we're not doing that next week.
We should do that just because you seem to have some axes to grind.
I don't know anything about it. I feel like I've seen it, but it's very early in The Rock's career, from what I remember.
Everybody likes The Rock.
Yeah, well, they do now.
I mean, you know, everybody's got to start from somewhere. You gotta start from your WWE and your Tsunkatsi and work your way up.
Your what?
Tsunkatsu. Remember when we did what's it called? The one with Sean William Scott.
The Rundown?
Yes, The Rundown. And I explained to you the Star Trek Voyager episode where they tried to do a tie-in with wrestling.
Oh, right,
and
right. Where he just got the thing on his forehead and he's wearing the little underwear.
So the silver spandex whatever unitard thing. And then he fights Jerry Ryan, who plays 709. Mm-hmm. And it's bad, so bad. But anyway, everybody's going to start somewhere.
Tsukatsi is the name of the late night infomercial brand of knives that he purchases in that episode.
Yes, it is. It was something he was trying to save up for through fighting. Unfortunately, he injured his hands. But Jerry Ryan went through all the trouble to get him those knives, but she unfortunately could no longer taste anything. And then that way, by the end,
he traded the use of his hands for the knives, and she traded her taste for his freedom to cook or something.
Yeah, and then he couldn't cook food that would please her anymore. And it's a real Gift of the Magi story.
It's a very tragic ending. Yeah,
the Gift of the Tsunkatsu. But so anyway, it's not any weirder than the Olive Garden, but so
I think it's a couple of deeper than the Olive Garden.
It takes more explaining. They go through this process of allowing all of these cameos and whatever and stuff, and it's interesting. This movie does not seem related in DNA form to the other two movies in terms of how it's shot and put together, etc. So I would not like put all three of these together and watch it back to back and be like, look at this series of flawless films. Because
no, I mean, Tarantino's always going to be out there on his own ledge, and Soderbergh has his own thing in weird ways that I personally like. I'm a big fan of Soderbergh and his oddities because they are not things that I would ever have thought to do, and they don't really make sense to me, but I feel like they work artistically. You know, your mileage may vary, apparently.
And Sonnenfeld is, I feel, much more predictable in terms of what he's doing. He's giving you a more straightforward movie, I feel like, with Get Shorty than these movies do. But back to this. There's the hot tip about where Ving Rhames is hiding out. She goes to talk to Adele, and Luis Guzman shows up, and he wants to confront Adele because he wants to get back at George Clooney because his partner died as a result of their escape, etc. attempt.
It's relatively clear at this point that Jack was the tip off because he also escaped and wasn't necessarily part of the plan. He even told them when they were running their laps that, no, I'm too old for this. I am not going to do any of that stuff. So,
yeah. Yeah. And, Luis Guzman, is so fun. in this,
you like his painter's outfit and his weird hat.
Yeah. It just is pronunciation of everything that he says. But also,
he's shouting through the door. In his box?
It's fun. But what I really like is when he tries to break in, and then J-Lo knocks his gun away and handcuffs him on the floor. And the whole entire time she's handcuffing him, he still wants to ask Adele how the magic trick works.
Yeah, so I love that he's like, he's even commenting on the handcuff. He's like, wow, you are mean, lady. Actually, the best part is, he's still asking Adele all the questions, and he gets so offended that magic is actually a trick and there are fake legs in the sawing the lady in half box, and he's being
How do they wiggle their toes?
And I like that Adele just like couldn't possibly care less. She's just like, whatever, have fun. She's like lighting her cigarette. But I love that as J-Lo was dragging him out the door, she drags him into the door frame and just smacks him. He's like, what the hell are you doing?
But she calls on her cell phone, her very 90s cell phone, to the FBI head agent guy, to say that if she catches one of these escapees, will she be on the task force? And the guy's like, yeah, sure, whatever, because obviously he doesn't expect her to have caught him. And then she did. And then he's like, you better come on over to, was it Adam's Hotel or whatever? Adam's Motel?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, to because we're busting Buddy. And so she goes on over there, and on the task force, earlier she had confronted FBI lead guy about his abilities and that how he might have been kind of somebody who processed white collar crime or something more often than actual like physically being on a bust. And that much is evident here where he's trying to call the shots and she's like, don't you want to not use a battering ram on a metal door? Or do you want to use something else? And the guy's like, oh, I got this other thing. And it's like, okay, yeah, we'll do that. And then he's dispatching everybody to go do various things. And he's like, and he gives her the task of waiting in the lobby, which she does. And the whole entire time this is going on, they're cutting back to the elevator where Ving Rhames and George Clooney are stuck on it with various elevator riders, like the old lady yes, who old lady. Doesn't know to get off on her own floor.
Two, please.
The door opens. She just stands there.
Mm-hmm.
But they go back down to the lobby. The guy gets off, and then George Clooney makes eye contact with Jennifer Lopez. She makes eye contact with him, and they both freeze. The elevator goes down. She doesn't think to report this to anybody. But she hears on the radio that that the guys are not inside of the place and to keep an eye out for them if they're leaving. Sure enough, nobody's watching the cars that were in the garage, which is apparently underneath all of this, which doesn't make any sense because if you're in Florida, you're not digging an underground garage. I'm just going to be perfectly honest with you. And they were on street level. You could see out the window. So it doesn't make
it's kind
any
of
sense.
It wasn't like that. Deep below ground. It's kind of like a split level. It's like a halfway below.
Dan, let me tell you about the Florida aquifer.
Ahead.
Underneath the ground in Florida is a lot of calcium and rocks and stuff. It's just limestone and it's nice. Porous. It's porous. It holds water. And that's where all the fresh water comes from in Florida. It's filtered by the natural limestone. And
I bet
a lot of people
tastes delicious.
Yeah, it's lovely. Delicious hard water. Everybody sets up their own wells, or you get it from a big processing plant that also pulls it from the aquifer. And the aquifer drains lakes because obviously you pull the water out of somewhere, and so the lakes go down, which is fantastic. Some of the lakes have dried up. But anyway, you don't go digging down into the ground because you're going to hit the aquifer. So nobody has a basement in Florida.
I feel obligated to say don't go chasing aquifers.
Listening for the underground garages that you're used to.
Yes. So they escape, luckily, and then, change cars, head up to Detroit.
Yeah. And they all decide to go to Detroit because they got their hot tip to do that. And Glenn, poor Glenn, he's got his Band-Aid around his head, like a headband, and he,
you know, like his, it's like a headband earmuff thing.
It's a look. He is with Snoop, and he doesn't go by Snoop anymore. He's Maurice now.
He's Mr. Maurice.
Mr. Maurice, and they have their introduction to him in his car. And the driver guy is a white boy, which is an interesting name. And it's a sort of bodyguard guy. And Snoop has a boxing gym thing that he has and does fights or whatever. But he's not really he's not successful, really, is the picture we get of him. As successful as you would like to project.
As a boxing trainer?
As anything, really.
Well, you know, as he says, he's into the occasional grand larceny, home invasion, stuff like that.
Yeah. And
vertically integrated, I believe, is the term he uses.
What we quickly find out is that Glenn made a very bad choice in coming up there and going to Snoop because Mr. Maurice has other plans and knows that Glenn is a pushover.
He has no spine, yeah, basically.
Yeah, and so he drags Glenn along to go pick up this other guy, and then they're going to go do this other thing, and Glenn's like, that's not part of my plan. Like, I brought you guys in on this. Like, you know, you guys aren't bringing me on this. And it's very clear that Glenn is in way, way over his head and doesn't really understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not locked in there with Glenn. Glenn's locked in there with Glenn.
Yeah, and so they go murder somebody, which is fun. And there's lots of dissolves for that. Meanwhile, Ving Rhames and George Clooney arrive in Detroit, and they try to like set up shop, and he has a flashback about some such other thing that I don't remember. What was it? Is this when he has the flashback about having the job? Yes, that is it. And that is when he has this flashback to the beginning of the movie, I think, when they're in the car. Yeah. And then he decides he's going to go do some other thing, and so he starts calling hotels. And sure enough, he finds the hotel where FBI agent lady has checked in with her name, and he makes his way over there.
You think that's poor OPSEC on her part?
I don't know that that's necessarily the best way to check into a hotel, but he finds out and goes over there. But she's tired from her day, and so she goes to sit down. Oh, and she went to the murder scene and talked to some cops that she knew about finding Mr. Maurice's address and
Raymond.
Getting the information on that.
Raymond, who's pretty good at you know, appearing busy and occupied, you know, getting people to move cars, calling people on the radio, trying to fit his dialogue in between such that it sounds natural.
Yes, there's a lot of car moving in his dialogue, but he's just like, yeah, sure, I'll give it to you tomorrow. And so she goes to the hotel, and she just wants to get a drink because it's been a long day, and she wants to sit by herself and not talk to anybody. And the waitress comes over and asks what she wants, and she says a bourbon. And what does she say? Like water on the back or something?
Water back, yeah. That's old people talk for, can I also have a glass of water?
I don't know.
I don't know why that is the term of art for ordering beverages, but yeah, don't talk like that.
Don't go chasing water backs.
Yeah. But, God, that sounds. Anyway, in honor of this scene, I also have some bourbon and a fizzy water back.
Oh, well, that's nice. Well, fizzy water back sounds like a real issue, though. But they have their little thing where the waitress goes over and she says, oh, these guys want to buy you your drink. And she's like, tell them no, and I'm not interested. And the waitress goes back over, and the guys are not interested in hearing no. And they come on over, and they're obnoxious. And it's really fun. I see, I like this part of the movie. Like, I like the obnoxious, like,
you
back
like the
and
guys
forth.
Who don't realize they're in a movie about an FBI agent and a bank robber?
Yeah, they're fun. I like that. Because it's fun for us as the audience, because you know just like Hitchcock said, like, put a FBI agent under the seat and the audience, you know, they all see it, but the characters don't.
You knew it was coming. You knew that poor Philip and poor Andy were gonna get shut down pretty hard.
Oh yeah, big time. Because she's not interested in them. She's interested in a bank robber. Also their drips.
their drips. Now who's the old person?
Yeah, me. So she shuts them down pretty good, and they go. The snow is falling against the translite, and in walks George Clooney.
At least it's an appropriately defocused translite.
Yeah, wrong perspective. But they have
to. What are you gonna do? You need to tilt down from an elevated perspective, and or adjust the pane of window back there so you can see their reflections without seeing the camera reflection.
Meh.
He didn't have the money to paint out the camera in that background.
I guess. So they have.
Although, I was a little surprised this movie was like $40-something million, $48 million budget estimated.
Does it feel cheaper than that?
It does feel a little bit cheaper than. I mean, you know, who knows? With there's a fairly substantial cast in this movie, and they actually did shoot a lot of stuff on location. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know where that money went, but
Detroit is an infamously costly place to shoot.
Yeah, exactly. All the way. Also, when every time I see this movie, which is frequently because I watch it anytime I get the opportunity, it reminds me that everyone who has ever made a movie thinks Detroit is blue. Detroit is always blue, and I don't know why. Just because I guess it's cold and sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's just like with Dean Cundey. Blue means it's nighttime or that it's cold or both. And so out the window,
or that your local economy has disappeared and everyone's depressed.
Yeah, people are feeling
blue. Is
it
too many words to communicate? That's why, you know, pictures worth a thousand words.
Yeah, just shorten it to people are feeling blue. So you're showing it through symbolism. But so
symbolism.
Symbolism. But Simba. But George Clooney walks in.
I was going Boondock Saints and you went Lion King.
You know, you take the high road and I'll take the low road. But
I think I took the low road on that one.
Let's be generous. George Clooney walks in, and they have their back and forth, and it's like Celeste and whatever. And
Gary, his name is Gary.
Gary, oh, what awful names.
Yeah, well, they don't have anything though. They're very boring people.
Well, I hope when they had their terrible sex later that they just kept shouting Celeste and Gary back at each other. But
I don't think that their relationship has stagnated to the point yet that they need to bring characters into it. But maybe, you know, later in life they can do that.
It seems to have stagnated to the point where they need to start with characters. But so they have him come in, and she's all goo-goo eyes over him. And they have their conversation about this stuff where they're trying to, like, get off on the right foot or whatever. And
they're having the moment that they, you know, sort of casually talked about earlier where they, you know, see what it would be like if they casually met in a bar and they didn't know that she was an FBI agent and he was a bank robber, and see, just see how they got along.
I didn't care for the scene. I know it's your favorite scene and I'm wrong, etc., but I just
forgive me when I steer into the artsy skit of this one, but the music, of course, again, the pacing, the way it's shot, the editing. I love the freeze frames. I love the intercutting between the scene that is currently taking place and the scene that we know we're leading up to back in the hotel room. I love the way it's put together. I think it appropriately builds the relationship, the sort of connection between the two of them, the fact that they're both just like fully getting hooked on this weird sort of taboo thing that's going on between them. And I think it works well. I very much like the artsy affectation of the freeze frames and the dissolves and stuff, and I think it works for this scene, because this is where they really hit their full stride with freeze frames and you know, dissolves and stuff. And I actually really like the way the freeze frames time with the music, of course. But anyway, I love everything about it. I think it is an expertly crafted scene.
Vom.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah,
Joe hates love. Whatever.
Yeah, it's such a road bump in this. But, you know, it might just be because I never bought into the relationship, so I'm not emotionally invested in this, so watching
it... You just need to watch it a couple more times very closely on a big TV with very loud audio.
I absolutely promise I will do that. So...
this is 2 weeks in a row where I convinced you to watch something a second time.
Yes, and I totally have fulfilled all of that.
You're completely 100% serious about all of it.
But I think that when you said loud volume, that's another thing that really bothered me about the scene. I don't know what was going on with the sound mix, but they're whispering to each other, like very softly talking to each other across this table. And the music is louder than their whispers are at some places.
Yeah, I don't. Were you on headphones? How were you watching this?
This was on a television set. But I had the air conditioner going, so I could hear the music, but I couldn't hear their dialogue over the air conditioner. So I had to turn off the air conditioner, and then it got warm. And,
and then you were just unhappy while you were watching this thing that you were being forced to watch. But
none of the other scenes are like this in terms of the sound. So I don't.
This scene should stand out in certain ways because it is a culmination of what we've been leading up to. But yeah, I'm probably the wrong person to ask because I know all the words to the scene because I've seen it so many times. But
recite the scene, Dan.
Like from start to finish?
Just your favorite part.
Oh, my favorite part.
Just do a part.
I'm incapable of doing that weird little smile George Clooney does when he says, that's not what you were going to say.
Well, I have some good news for you. This is an audio podcast. So nobody can tell.
Picture me doing a very charismatic little half smile like George Clooney.
Yes, yes. A little, I'm picturing right now.
A knowing smile.
George Clooney's patented smile.
He's entirely too charismatic. Although one of the things, while we're talking about George Clooney, that I read in there, I'm sure you saw too if you're looking through the trivia, was that Elmore Leonard was thinking of... Who did he say he was thinking of for the role? Sean Connery or Jack Nicholson? Were the people he had in mind when he wrote the book? It was like, oh, dear God, no.
No. Wait, when was this book written?
96.
Ooh. I was going to give him like the benefit of the doubt if it was written in the 70s or something, but Jesus.
I mean, you think about this character supposedly having robbed 50 banks or whatever and having a lifelong career of being a bank robber. You can see where... like that character would be sort of insinuating that they are a bit older than George Clooney is in this movie. But I'm very glad that they did not go that route.
Could you imagine? could you imagine this movie with the cast of As Good As It Gets?
Oh my God. You make me want to be a better FBI agent. No. It would have been. It would have turned into. What's that terrible movie? Entrapment with Catherine Zeta-Jones James Bond.
Sean Connery,
when he's just way too old for any of that to be appropriate or believable.
Well, there's lasers on here. Slide your butt under the lasers.
But anyway, so that's a bad movie. I hate Entrapment. But moving on. I don't hate this movie. I'm just not as enamored. And so we've been cutting back and forth across the line of action, which drove me nuts. But I'm the only person who cares about that because I'm boring, and it's perfectly fine to break the rules in cinema, especially for art reasons. And I'm just a dull, dull, boring, predictable
person.
Yeah,
why don't you like art, Joe? What's wrong with you?
I don't know. I'm just a horrible curmudgeon. But,
you hate love
so,
and you hate art.
Yeah, that's why I do what I do.
All you like is spaceships.
Fair point, except I don't work on spaceships.
That's probably why you love them. They haven't been ruined for you.
Yeah. They have their next morning thing because all the sex is over now, and he's lying there in bed, bare chested, and she's in the bathroom door, and they're talking about stuff, and the perspective on the background is completely wrong, and it's driving me nuts.
You're just looking out the window at the fake snow the whole time.
Well, the fake snow and the streets that are going upwards, that. Doesn't make any sense because the camera's flat and they're in a high rise.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there would really be nothing out there though otherwise.
Yep, there sure wouldn't. But nobody wanted to make the brave cinematic choice to just have snow falling out the window. But anywho, they have their city with perfectly static street lights and just the strobing aerial lights on top of towers. And I just stared at that the entire conversation. Not to dismiss George Clooney's bare-chested charisma, but the scene doesn't do much for me. But they have a conversation about how she really wished she had her gun back, and how he can't help being a bank robber, etc. It's like the old Aesop fable about the frog and the scorpion, and the
She's realizing that she's in too far with this relationship. She has passed the point of appropriateness for a person in her position. I mean, just in terms of like general vulnerability around somebody that you've just been intimate with. And also the fact that she's an FBI agent, like all of this is sort of coming together after they've been sort of thinking about this meeting the entire movie. The reality of it comes crashing down afterward, and she is realizing that she doesn't super love herself for some of the choices she's made, and she sort of takes the offensive in the conversation, saying like, you know, I'm not just some psychotic thrill seeker over here, like, if that's what you're, you know, thinking of me, or because you're probably just as confused about how this happened as I am, blah blah blah, just trying to be, you know, the aggressor in the conversation. He's just like, just chill out. Like, that's not what's going on here. We have an actual real bond between the two of us. So just, you know, it's just calm down. It's okay. Don't worry about it. I'm not judging you.
Yeah. And so the scene ends with the next morning, and she wakes up in bed, and she has her pistol, which seems unsafe. But
we don't know that it was loaded, or at least chambered.
Yeah, you know, well, she's got it now, and he had gone in the middle of the night. There's this whole thing where she goes to talk to, because it's the next morning. She obviously has the address that she needed, and she goes to Moselle and Kenneth. Mm-hmm. I want to say Kenneth, mm-hmm. There's a confrontational scene about what Mr. Maurice has been up to and stuff, and how
like
she wants
they're maintaining the Mr. Maurice.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's either that or Snoop. And how they want to have she wants to get Glenn, is what she says, to try to get them on her side. And there's kind of a sob story about how unsuccessful and bad he is at things. And Kenneth is all like, "Oh, I was a boxer till I detached my retinas 2 times, and they said I couldn't box anymore, but I'm still amazing, and I'm lovely, and
I certainly have not pivoted into inappropriate coping mechanisms with regard to my aggression."
No, and then she beats the crap out of him and leaves.
Yeah, with the baton.
Yeah, she's a good job with that one. By the way,
quick side note, do you know just anybody is allowed to buy those?
Really?
Yep.
I guess it is just a stick.
Makes sense. It's a very hard piece of metal with a little metal ball in the end. They're like $30. Pretty great.
Oh, do you own one?
I do. I had it tucked in the pouch of the on the back of the passenger seat of my Mustang for a very long time in case I needed to get to it. I've never used it for anything. It's just like one of those keep it in your car kind of defense mechanism things. But yeah, I have one.
Dan, do you know what keep it in my car defense mechanism I have?
Your phone for calling 911?
You're darn right. that's it. What the heck are you doing driving around with a metal baton just in case you need it? I mean, what? Yeah.
I bought it when I was like 19, so don't worry. Like, it's not. It's one of those things.
Ugh.
Oh, these are fancy ones. It's not one of the ones with where you push the button and it springs out. You have to actually flick it with your wrist.
I just like the ones in Demolition Man, where they just like had that little sound effect and like you could tap somebody on the head and it would stun them.
Oh yeah, the little electrical guys. Yeah, those were good.
Yeah. But anywho, she beats the crap out of him because the information she basically got out of the scene is that he's often at fights, and so she's gonna go to a fight and stake it out, and that's where she catches Steve Zahn, who is very nervously going to go to the bathroom, and announces to the table that he's gonna go to the bathroom.
Yeah, I love that he's trying to act natural and act macho around all of these crazy guys. He's like, you know what, I gotta take a pee. It's like, what are you telling us for? Just go to the bathroom.
Yeah. I believe White Boy says, "What do you want us to do? Hold your pecker?" That's
I love White Boy. Nice. Bob, he's so stupid.
He's not a brilliant man. But he provides some comedy. So Steve Zahn, of course, goes out to the back door to the parking area and then gets into his car and tries to hotwire it. And he's busted by J-Lo, who says that he's stealing a car. And he says, "How can I steal a car? I already stole this car last week."
Yes.
I just don't have the
keys.
And
as he's sneaking out, Kenneth like knows that something's suspicious. He goes to go chase after him. And Maurice just basically tells him to sit back down because doesn't care. Basically, he already knows that Steve Zahn's running away. It just doesn't care because they're changing the plan on him. They're going to go do the robbery tonight rather than tomorrow because Glenn's an idiot loudmouth and he's probably going to ruin it anyway. So we're going to get in there a day early and just go take care of it before anyone knows what's going on.
And Steve Zahn tells J-Lo that he thinks that Maurice is going to kill George Clooney's character once they do this thing.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious, too. Again, like George Clooney had the plan to, you know, figure out, go to the meeting, figure out what they're planning on doing, and then go in a day early and get the diamonds out before they get a chance. And it turns out Maurice had the exact same idea. And the fact that Maurice had that idea, given who Maurice is, would lead us to believe that he's going to use that opportunity to tie up all of his loose ends, i.e. killing George Clooney.
Yes. And so he gives them 2 minutes to decide whether or not they're going to go along with his plan. And George Clooney is like, I got backup. And then there's the shot of them staring off to the camera. Because I believe he knows that Chelo is gonna help him out. But
I'm not sure that I read that into the scene.
Well, he's staring at something.
I thought he was just looking back at the table full of guys.
I guess. So Ving Rhames and George Clooney are along for the ride, literally, as they drive in the Prudential or Provincial or whatever plumbing truck to go to Ripley's house. And they are being tailed by J-Lo, who knows that something's up. She sees them. She sees White Boy Bob stumble with the suitcase on their way into the car. And then they get into the car and go off. And they've all got ski masks on. They arrive. She calls it in and says that she's going to need backup because there's four armed assailants that have entered the Ripley's mansion. Now, apparently he lives in the sticks because nobody got out there for like a good long time. But anyway, they have White Boy Bob ring the doorbell and pretend to be a repairman who was summoned because they got a house call. And then the maid answers the door and he very aggressively takes custody of her. And then they all go in and they confront her about it. Why she's there, where's Ripley, blah, 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 blah. She says Ripley is in Palm Beach and that he is there at this time of year from Christmas till Easter, and that that's just how it is. And George Clooney criticizes Mr. Maurice for not checking to see whether or not Ripley would be in town. So now they are tasked with trying to find the stash of uncut diamonds that are somewhere in here. And they resolve to go up to the bedroom and start scoping stuff out. And
I love how quickly Maurice gets bored and starts basically just stealing suits.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like such a petty thing to be doing, but he is, of course, somebody who is in trouble for doing petty things.
Well, he really was able to put together an outfit that was working for him, so he's fine.
And that, of course, led him to find where the safe was. But meanwhile, downstairs, Ving Rhames goes up to the room and says that George Clooney is scoping the other rooms as he was instructed to do. So
and he immediately gives it away by like trying to play into Maurice's ego and saying he's checking the other rooms, boss. And Snoop is just like, okay, you're full of it, clearly, yeah. Already.
Yeah, and so he sends White Boy Bob out to go find and keep an eye on George Clooney's character.
He doesn't make it very far, though.
No, he gets immediately distracted by the first room he goes to off of the hallway, which is the kitchen, and he opens it up and finds a bunch of frozen steaks, which he confiscates.
Big ones, man.
Yeah. I genuinely love how easily distracted he is by all of this stuff, but he takes the steaks to the car and stuff. Meanwhile,
I also love it. It's such a perfect character moment for him when he's taking them out to the car and he drops one of them and he's got like 30 more in his arms and he like bends down to pick up the one that he dropped and ends up setting all of them back down on the ground. It's like, yeah. Oh, you're an idiot. Yeah. It's fun.
Yeah. And George Clooney goes to this study where he sees a fish tank, which he knows that Ripley likes fish, and so goes over there and then sees that there are rocks in there, and kind of from this, I at least intuited that the uncut diamonds were inside the fish tank, but
yeah,
we got the delivery of that line much later when Ving Rhames meets up with him. But
and he says verbatim what George Clooney had said to Glenn in the very beginning of the movie, that they look like plain old rocks, literally the phrase, just like plain old rocks. So you know that they're on the same page. And this is the second like minor detail that, again, I totally overlook because I love this movie, but still is wrong and it bothers me, is that they are not uncut diamonds that look like plain old rocks. They are partially cut diamonds that are basically like slightly square shaped, and they kind of look like, I don't know, maybe some sort of quartz you would throw in the bottom of a fish tank, but they do not look like, quote, just like plain old rocks.
Yeah. But that's later. So anyway, he sees a phone cord running to the bathroom, because obviously this is the era where people would still have phones with cords. And
even the rich people, they're just like us.
So he goes over to the bathroom and opens the door and finds Ripley in there and invites him to come out and confronts him about stuff. And now this starts a sequence of events that the director of photography was very interested in the ceiling of the study. So we got to stare at it.
It was a good looking study. Oh, did you read the thing on the trivia that said the people who used the that offered them the exterior of the house when they saw the movie, they liked the fake set that was the interior of the house so much they asked for the plans?
No.
Yeah. Which is a very stupid thing and is probably not entirely true, but they're like, oh wow, that's what's inside this fake house that ours is the outside for. We should make the inside of our house look like the set, because that's a really nice looking set.
Wow.
Not really how renovations should or do work, but whatever.
No. But anywho, they get to chatting, very friendly chat, all things considered, about things. And
certainly more friendly than the chat he's about to have with Maurice when he comes down and finds him.
Right. And so they talk about this stuff, and Ving Rhames comes in and they get the rocks, and they're like, we're going to leave now, et cetera. 5.2 million or whatever in uncut diamonds. And so they get out to the car, and then George Clooney has a twinge of regret, because he's like, they're going to rape and murder the maid, aren't they? And it's like, yeah, they're totally going to do that. And so he's like, okay, well, Ving Rhames, you take the diamonds and you ditch the car at the airport, and I'm going to go back in there. And Ving Rhames gives him his gun and stuff. And so
he's a bank robber, but he's not a monster. And while he not necessarily responsible for everything that occurs in that house, he did kind of instigate everything, so he feels slightly obligated to go back in and at least defend Midge, maybe not so much Ripley, because screw him.
Yeah. And sure enough, he goes back inside and he goes up the stairs to find Midge in bed with the guy, and Midge throws the blanket over the guy to distract him because he's got a gun. But so George Clooney gets his first three or whatever shots off and kills that guy before he can shoot his gun. And so he falls over dead. And then he makes sure Midge is okay. And then he goes downstairs. Goes back to the hallway to go downstairs, but he's confronted by White Boy Bob, who's got a gun and got the drop on him. So he gets George Clooney to drop his gun. And then White Boy Bob starts going up the stairs. And now the thing of him slipping and falling earlier in the film, several times, that comes into play here, where he literally slips and falls on the stairs. And there is a very graphic shot of the gun going up underneath his chin and then shooting his brains out, which is done well, edited well, tightly. So it leaves a very lasting impression in your mind, but you're seeing very little of it. They do that. And it doesn't feel like it's out of nowhere, because we've been watching him trip and been watching him be a klutz this whole entire time. So it doesn't necessarily seem like a surprise. It is shocking when it happens, because it's just such a weird thing to see somebody, blow their own brains out on a staircase. But, that is what happens. And George Clooney's just like, can't believe his luck. Maurice had gone up the other stairwell in the back, and so he's shooting at him from the other side now. He goes, George Clooney goes behind a column, and Maurice runs out of bullets, and then George Clooney does the classic mistake of walking too close to the person you're having a gun on.
Yeah, you know, there's a little bit of banter back and forth about, you know, you're not really a gun guy. He's like, no, you know, yeah. He's like, well, you're probably getting nervous right now. He's like, yeah, why take the chance though? So let's just get this out of the way. And he tries to shoot him. And his gun's empty, because he's got a little six shooter. And then there's a delightful little scrappy battle, which I'm not sure why George Clooney thought this was advisable rather than running away, given that Maurice used to be a boxer, but whatever. They fight. And then eventually Maurice kind of realizes that there's a loaded gun in the hand of dead White Boy Bob on the stairs just below, and attempts to escape from the fight just long enough to slide down and go grab that, and he does, and he grabs the gun and points it at Jack just in time for Jennifer Lopez to come in the door with her sig pointed at him.
Mm-hmm. And so she shoots Don Cheadle and he goes down. And then George Clooney ducks into the bedroom and she's calling for him to come out, and he comes out and with the ski mask on, and he's got the gun and he's dropped the bullets out of it.
And he knows the jig is up, and at this point, this is, you know, getting back to his philosophy from earlier. You know, it's a couple different instances where he says, you know, they put a gun on you, you still have a choice. And, you know, when he was talking about Bonnie and Clyde, you know, that wouldn't be such a bad way to go if you had a choice versus, you know, dying in prison as a very old man. So he's trying to take the death by police option here, and you know, a little selfish. Also, J-Lo is not particularly interested in killing her weird robber boyfriend. So after a little bit of an emotional back and forth, she shoots him in the leg and then handcuffs him to the pole of the stairs there. And then that's when everybody else, all of the other cops and Raymond, show up to assess the scene where everyone is dead except for George Clooney, who has been shot in the leg.
I like how you said all the other cops, because it's just... It's just the one guy and then the other guy.
There's like three or four that come in, but they like run away yeah. very quickly.
Yeah, they obviously did not have enough money for shooting personnel for that day. But so they have the thing where he's been apprehended, and she has a phone thing with Dennis Farina being like, oh, well, you could drive your boyfriend down here. And I don't know why he's so into this.
He's just, you know... He's being sassy dad in his dad way, but sort of not really talking about the fact that he understands that she's kind of in too deep with this whole thing. But he's like, yeah, you can pick up where your interlude left off and then drive him down to Florida and then throw him in the clink. And then you'd be good to go.
I want to see the prequel with the young Dennis Farina who fell in love with a lady who was committing crimes, and they had a brief tete-a-tete. But anyway.
I would watch that. Is there anybody currently acting that could play a young Dennis Farina?
I can't think of a single human being, but there might be somebody that I'm just not aware of.
Is there anybody else who was a former police officer who's really got that that cop face thing going on?
Can't think of anybody.
Hmm.
But she resolves to go take him in the thing, in the wagon, on down for the prison transfer for him to go to Belglades. And he's in the van. She hands him a lighter because he had a thing about his lighter thing. And she says that she's going to have to take it back by the end of their ride. And then in comes Sam Jackson. And we're all like, whoa, Sam Jackson. Surprise cameo.
What's up, buddy?
Yeah, and he's like, I've escaped from so many prisons. I've escaped from lots of prisons. I've escaped from big prisons, small prisons.
All kinds of prisons.
Yeah, and so it's interesting.
One prison, two prison, red prison, blue prison.
so he's like, yeah, I was scheduled to go last night, but the lady marshal didn't want to take me down there until today for some reason, and... it's like, it's a figure.
Must be cheaper to drive two of us together at the same time.
Yeah, figured we have something to talk about. And it's like, what could that possibly be? Could it be escaping from prison? But
what I would love to know, I want to know so much about what happens after the credits roll in this movie. Like, does he go like, yeah, the things that she probably assumes we have to talk about is the fact that she's kind of my weird girlfriend, and she can't help me escape, but she probably wants me to escape so we can go live on an island together and be happy and in a relationship. So you're good at escaping, and I've escaped before, and she's my girlfriend, so let's figure this thing out. Like, is he gonna like try and say that thing to her next time they go to a gas station to fill up or something?
Maybe. Although I just realized this is her second lover that she's shot, for yeah. robbing.
Uh-huh.
Cause earlier there's a passing line about her, bank robber, wasn't ex-husband, but her bank robber boyfriend or whatever that she yeah. apprehended.
She was dating somebody who was also robbing banks and she ended up shooting him.
Yeah. Which is an interesting pattern for her, but,
yeah, she's got a type. It happened.
She'd probably be examined by some sort of psychotherapist, but so that concludes the movie, and
you know, you can't pick what you're attracted to, Joe.
No, you certainly can't. Now, far be it for me to criticize her type of her preference. Because all in all, this movie makes it seem like George Clooney is a pretty stand-up guy, except for robbing people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, most of those places are federally insured, so it's not really that big a deal.
Yeah, I mean, he's only psychologically scarring the bank tellers. It's fine.
A victimless crime. I mean, you got to believe that when the police raid the place and take down random guy over there talking to Mr. Gwendon, she's going to find out that, like, that guy was not an accomplice and there was no gun in there. She's going to feel kind of duped or whatever, but, like, she's not going to feel like my life was in danger and I should be traumatized. She's going to be like, oh, him, he played a trick on me.
I don't know.
Yeah, he reminds her, you know, just breathe. You know, take your time. You're doing great. No bills off the bottom of the drawer.
You've seen this movie a lot.
I've seen this movie a lot, yes.
Yeah. Well.
Also, that scene, most of that scene is on the soundtrack, too.
Oh. You know what I don't love in soundtracks?
Audio clips?
Yeah. I don't really
Don't have a lot. You probably don't have a lot of Tarantino soundtracks then, do you?
No. I don't think I have a single
audio
one.
Audio clips.
No, but one thing that really bothers me is the Blade Runner, the original one, that has a lot of dialogue in there. And also Flash Gordon, that has got some dialogue inserted in it. I just don't know.
At least they're separate tracks. Can't you just, like, uncheck them so they don't play?
No, these aren't separate tracks. They mix it in with the music.
Oh, no. There's maybe one or two little instances of that on this soundtrack, but they're mostly separate tracks.
Okay. Well, that's not so bad. But that concludes this. And just like the Olive Garden, we have to leave because we got to go to the bathroom and no longer be around other people.
We had too much sangria.
Yeah. Oh, no. Wait, can you get sangria there?
Hell yeah, you can get sangria. I mean, I haven't personally consumed sangria at Olive Garden, but I know people who have.
I have never had alcohol at an Olive Garden before.
How do you get through? They got all those giant jugs of Chianti there, just like for the taking.
Dan, I have some news for you.
You haven't been to an Olive Garden since you lived in Florida, have you?
I went to an Olive Garden one time with my aunt, who lived out here at the time, and she was meeting in Burbank. So we met at the Burbank Olive Garden. That's inside of an enormous shopping center.
You couldn't find anything better in Burbank?
There were lots of better options. She suggested the Olive Garden. So I had a salad. It was completely underwhelming, as expected.
The salad is really an item of nostalgia. It's a known entity.
Who's nostalgic for a salad, Dan?
They sell Olive Garden salad dressing at grocery stores and other places. Like, it is a thing.
Oh, that's revolting.
There was a time where the salad was good and the breadsticks were fresh, and now it's, you know, not so much. Now it's just like, I don't know how they've managed to make the entire salad like the core of an iceberg head of lettuce, but that's kind of what it is.
Oh, man. I like how
there's
just
like one olive in it for the whole giant like bowl.
Wow, you were just like a very young boomer.
I'm from the suburbs, for f**k's sake. Like, excuse me, I forgot we're not on the after show yet.
Whoa!
I thought we were officially in the after show.
Officially no. It's not a thing that speaks to me. And I've been to other horrible chains. Your Romano's Macaroni's Grill and your your Carrabba's.
Ours went out of business. It was empty for a very long time, and they tore it down. We still have a Carrabba's.
Oh.
Which is, the Carrabba's, it's great. Like, a long time ago, when the area was less built up, they took one little corner of a dirt lot, and they added a Carrabba's next to an Outback Steakhouse next to a Charleston's. Like, they're all, like, bang, bang, bang right there next to each other. And you're like, this is chain restaurant corner.
Well, I don't know about Charleston, but I know that Outback owns Carrabba's.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the owners of Outback and Carrabba's are terrible. So please don't patronize your establishment.
Yeah, it was also across the street from... Oh, I always get this wrong. It was across the street from a TGI Fridays, not a Chili's, but that thing burned down, and then they turned it into a Longhorn Steakhouse, which is absolutely terrible.
I think they also own that, too. But anyway, aside from these franchised eateries, we should probably wrap this up. And I should say that... Well, I didn't necessarily enjoy this. I didn't hate it. I can appreciate this more, I think, as a look back on where Soderbergh was getting started. This is like the proto beginning of Soderbergh, the Proteberg.
Proteberg.
But this is what I think of is mainly like he went on to do better things than this. Is what I think of when I watch this. Because I think later things more than this thing.
Just get it out and say you love Magic Mike.
I do love Magic Mike, but I also really like Ocean's 11. And for some reason, I've never seen 12, but I have seen 13. I don't know why that is. Everybody said 12 was bad, but 13 didn't seem great either.
you have to, they kind of build on each other a little bit. I don't know. You should see 12. It's fine.
I guess. Maybe someday we'll do the oceans. All the oceans.
All of the oceans? I have seen all of them.
You see Ocean's 8?
I saw Ocean's 8 one and a half times, yes.
Oh, is it good?
It's fine. Okay. It does a lot of the same things where you're like, oh, there's a double, triple, quadruple, turns out, and it's just not as clever as... And the director, I forget who directed that, is trying to do a little bit of a Soderbergh-y thing, but they just kind of get tired of it after a little while, and you're just like, we'll just make this like a regular movie.
Okay.
But if we do that, we have to start with the original Ocean's 11.
The Frank Sinatra one?
Yeah, hell yeah.
I've never seen that.
Oh, it's great.
Is it?
Well, if you like the Rat Pack at all, which you probably don't.
Do I? I like music by Old Blue Eyes and by Dean Martin, who, you know, just likes to be drunk and blurt out various food items that have Italian names in songs.
But, I don't think that's his go-to move, but sure.
Yeah,
you know, Sammy Davis Jr.'s in there. You got Joey Bishop. You got all the boys there.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe we'll put that on the calendar for some point. But that concludes this yes. Soderbergh experience.
To sum up what you've said about the movie, it's fantastic. You loved it. It was flawless, and everyone else should love it and appreciate it as well.
Oh, thank you, Attorney General Bill Barr. But
oh God.
There we go. The end.
That was a low blow.